All right, welcome everyone to Reading Like a Writer character. I did one this morning on perspective. I don't know if any of it, we still have people just staying in this room all day because it's so lousy outside, but hopefully you're learning a lot. That is would be good. So my name is Michelle Hoover. I'm the author of the novels The Quickening and Bottomland. I teach writing at Brandeis University, and I also lead the Grub Street Novel Incubator Program. And our authors, I'm going to introduce them right before they do their readings. And we'll just go kind of one person at a time, 20 or so minutes. And as they read their excerpts aloud, so Reading Like a Writer, we're really looking at, okay, what are they doing in the excerpt to solve particular problems in terms of craft problems, in terms of character in this particular session. So feel free to make notes in your handouts, be ready to ask questions, and because we do like to try to involve the audience as much as possible. So we're going to start with Jaap Robin, who is a poet, playwright, and performer, and an acclaimed children's author. This is his first novel for adults, the award-winning You Have Me to Love. And it's the story of Mikhail, whose father drowns in attempting to save him near their island home. In her mourning, his mother begins to force Mikhail to replace his father in every way possible. It's a really haunting book. Telegraph calls the book unbelievable, a beautiful story, light for all its heaviness, written in a clear and powerful style, a coming-of-age tale in which Robin merges grief, simplicity, and isolation in a phenomenal way. Okay, yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, I thought about introducing the book, but you did it actually really well. So I think I don't have to introduce it. In the beginning of the book, Mikhail is 9 years old. And just before the beginning of the book, actually, his father disappears into the sea and he's with him. And he does not really understand what happens. And he goes home. And actually, you follow Mikhail and his mother the first weeks after his father disappeared. And then later on, when he's 15... They still live on that very remote island. He just with his mother and a neighbor and an abandoned house. And this is in the morning when his mother has given Mikhail her bedroom for his birthday. So they changed bedrooms because she said, "You're growing up. You're getting too tall for your room, for your bed. We change. I'm going to sleep in the attic and you sleep in my bed." And this is a couple of nights later when at night, he wakes up. The flushing of the toilet in the bathroom has woken me, followed by the sound of water gushing through the pipes in the wall. I listen to the landing groan under Mom's feet. From here, it sounds almost the same as in my old room. I expect to hear the attic stairs creak next, but they don't make a sound. Instead, I hear my door open. "Mom?" My hand gropes around the light cord above my bed. She hits the switch by the door at exactly the same moment, and the ceiling lights flashes on and off in a heartbeat. I catch a snapshot of her in a washed-out nightshirt, her back to me, legs lit up, finger by the light switch, then it goes dark again. "Huh?" she mumbles drowsily. "Broken." I slowly let go of the cord, and the fluorescent bead on the end swings to and fro against the wallpaper. "Broken," she mumbles again. In the dark, I hear her feet shuffling toward the side of the bed. Air rushes under the covers as she lifts them up and rolls onto the mattress. I make myself as small as I can. "Warm," she sighs. "Nice warm bed." She tugs at the covers, and I feel the sheet drag across my stomach. I'm lying at the edge of the bed, as far from her as I can get, muscles tensed. I try to hold the rise and fall of my chest, arms stiff at my sides. I listen to all the little sounds of her breathing. I swear I can hear the flicker of her eyelashes. Each time I take a breath, it whistles in my ears like the wind through the window. When I swallow, it's enough to shake the bed. Mom turns onto her side. I want to get up and go up to my old room, but the warmth of the bed keeps me under the covers. Mom's breathing slows and deepens. She's lying so close, she's almost pushing me onto the floor. But her nearness makes me the thought of the cold mattress up in the attic even colder. This isn't my fault. It's hers. I was sleeping and she came and lay down next to me. I didn't even notice. She can't pin the blame on me in the morning. Her teeth grinned gently.
So how did you go about creating this character and particularly this power dynamic here?
Yeah, I was thinking that most of us are grown up in a social context. Like you've got neighbors or you've got friends where you go home and then you see that there are dads who play football with their sons and some dads make jokes you do not really understand. And my dad always used to read the newspaper and I prefer the dads who make jokes I did not understand. But so you have a kind of way, other people are kind of a mirror for you. So you find out my parents do these things strange and I prefer those things like we do it more than other people do it. But for Mikael, living on that island, he's so remote. And he's 9 when his father disappears and he's got only as a mirror his mother. And she's coming a little closer and little closer and little closer, but it's like a millimeter every day. So he does not really know and he doesn't really feel when she's coming too close. And in my imagination, I always had kind of a imaginary experiment, like, I would ask you, do you mind if I point at you? No, you said no. So that's thank you very much for working with me. But if I would point at you and this does not really hurt you, or it's maybe a little strange and awkward because of all the other people. And when I ask, do you mind if I come a little closer? No, you don't mind. And we could take a day for this one, but I do it a little quicker. And then I come a little close and even more and even more. And then you would say, after a while, when I come this close, you would say, no, it's really awkward now. But then I said, yeah, but does it hurt? No, it does not really hurt. And then I come even more closer. And I come more closer. And then I won't come too close. But when I, in the end, almost touch your eye, you would say, no, now it's really, it starts to be painful. And then I really touch your eye, and I put my nail, and then you said, oh, now it hurts. But when I started here, you laughed and you said, yes, okay. And that's exactly the same thing I had in my book, when the mother is like a mother and she's coming really in really small steps a little bit closer. Mikael has to find out his own borders when his mother is coming too close and he can't look at friends or how other mothers do that. Then in the end, he finds out when it comes too close, it's too far. But he also feels guilty because he said yes, or he said he didn't say no. And that's what a lot of people struggle with, I think, is that if something happened, you feel also a little guilty because you did not say no in the beginning because you didn't even notice something is getting closer to you.
And it creates so much tension throughout the novel because you keep waiting, like what is going to be what line is going to be crossed here? And it just goes by teeny little. And I would just think that would take so much patience as a writer to hold back, to hold back, to hold back. Because I see so many writers, they just go for it. You know, people are in bed together and then you have no plot left. You're like, wait a minute, now what are you going to do? Allowing just those teeny little boundaries to be crossed, I thought you did so well. It makes the whole book.
Thank you. Yeah, for me, it's writing also like looking for the best detour from the beginning to the end. I can write about when she's coming too close or when she's even crossed the border or the mm-hmm. the. We say border.
Boundary.
Or boundary. Nobody said.
It's you about
the no,
same.
No, it's not border. You should say boundary.
I think border works too.
Yeah. Okay. A border boundary. What was I gonna say?
You can't always see what she's going to cross.
When you cross it, that boundary, everybody can imagine what is crossing that boundary. But when you go there really slowly, that boundary also moves a little.
Yeah.
And I like that in writing to discover where's my boundary and when do I reach it and can I move it a little.
Yeah. And it's so it's important also to look at in every scene that you're writing between characters to look at their power dynamics. I mean, hopefully that there is a little play of power dynamics. That's what's going to create the tension. If all your characters in your scenes have exactly the same power dynamics, or if those power dynamics never change or slip, you're going to have a very flat scene and a very dull book. So here it's interesting. The mother definitely has the power at the beginning of the scene. I think there's a slight turn when at the end he says, "This isn't my fault, it's hers." And notice he's trying to take power back right there. You know, I'm an autonomous person. I'm not going to be blamed for this. So it's his little desperate, and it's quiet, but there's a little turn in the scene of him trying to take the power back. What's also important to think about are your character's intentions. So every character, including the dog, maybe even the goldfish, needs to have intention in a scene. And if you don't, you'll never have conflict or power negotiations or anything. So here, the mother's intention is what?
That's what I wanted to write about. That you're not sure of her intentions, because mm-hmm. as a son, he's always watching his mother. And I wanted to write about the mother. When I look at my own mother, I could get as close as I wanted, not physically, but I could always be with her in a room, and I did not ever have to be afraid of her. But he's always watching. Can I get closer, or do I have to keep distance? And his mother is not aware of getting too close, or for her too, it's her finger is also moving really slowly towards her son. So in that case, I think she's not really aware of going into his room, or and maybe she has mistaken those rooms, because that's what Mikael is thinking too. She's so used to her sleeping room. She slept there for 20 years. Right. And now it's 3 nights later, and she goes half sleeping to the toilet, walks back, and she's forgotten, or maybe she's not forgotten, and you're not sure of that. And I wanted to look for that you're not really sure, is she doing this by accident or not? And that's mm-hmm. what inspired me.
So that's fascinating to think about when you're thinking about character intentions. What are they conscious of? What are they unconscious of? What are they hiding? So the idea of intention can be really complex. And his intention in the scene, I think, is just to stay asleep. Right?
And
stay warm.
And he liked to be close to his mother, because there's one sentence in the book I always went back to when I was writing, and I don't know it. Maybe I can find it very quickly. But it was like, we came no closer than opposite sides of the table. And for me, that was always what I had to go back to, because I thought two people living in a house, a mother and a son, and there's always something between them. In this case, it's a table. They don't come closer than that. So, and he really longs to be with his mother, but he feels the guilt, and his mother feels the anger. So when she comes into his room, he maybe likes her company, or he likes that they are kind of closer to each other, and he misses that. So mm-hmm. he wants it, and on the other side, he feels uncomfortable with it, and he thinks, I'm doing something wrong, or this is too close, but he also likes the warmth of being mm-hmm. together in a bed, and he's also still a child. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it's, he's also not sure of what he really wants.
Mm-hmm. And so that intention is, so it's in each scene, and it can be different in each scene, but it's always going to be connected to their larger intentions or their larger and deeper yearnings throughout the book. And both of these characters desperately want intimacy and comfort and closeness. They're just seeking it out in different ways and kind of feeling that out. And notice some of the choices here. You know, she's just wearing a T-shirt, her back to me. I love that line, legs lit up. And you think, oh, wait, she doesn't have pants on. I'm from Iowa, and I grew up in a Baptist family. So to me, that's like, whoa. And then you have her saying, broken. And that also kind of, it has double meanings for me. Like, there's something off here. There's something wrong. There's the constant repetition of breath. He can even hear the flicker of her eyelashes. There's so much intimacy there. There's so much space. They're getting way too close. And I was also curious, you wrote children's books.
Yeah,
right?
But if I can say something about the eyelashes. Of course, you can't hear eyelashes. So he's so extremely focused on what he's hearing that he thinks he hears her eyelash, but you can't hear eyelashes.
Right.
And that's what I wanted to write, that you can have kind of an over-focus, that you are so extremely focused that you, in everything, you hear something. And that's when it's so silent and when it's so dark in a room, you can just listen at things to get some signs from and think, oh, she's moving, or now she's walking, or now these are eyelashes.
And it hints at him wanting to hear that or wanting to that closeness, even though it's impossible. Yeah. And I was going to say, you also wrote children's books, and then this is a young voice. Do you see yourself kind of continuing with the young voice, or is it, do you kind of like working with a young voice for...
Yeah, it's a good question. Yeah, my second book is just published in the Netherlands at the same day this was published in the United States. So I can compare it now. And it's also from the viewpoint of a child. He's 13 years old, and this book is 15. But I like the viewpoint of a child because, especially when they are a little younger, you have kind of a mix between fantasy and reality, and your imagination, things you don't understand, you make up yourself with your ideas, or you think, oh, maybe it works like that or works like that. And the impact of things can be so enormous, but as a child, you're not aware of it. Mm-hmm. So a couple of weeks ago, I met a friend of mine, and she divorced, and she said, no, but my son, after a month, they lived somewhere else, said, oh, I'm already used to it, to this life. And I thought, that is impossible. And she was really happy with it because she said, no, oh, thanks. But he cannot imagine what the impact is of the divorce of his parents, but he wants to please her, and that's why he says it. But the impact, he can see it 20 years later, and maybe that it's a small impact, but that's what I like from the viewpoint of a child. You're not aware of what the impact can be of what happens, or you don't know what the meaning is of many things, or you understand this and that, and the missing link between that you imagine, or you think could be something like that. Mm-hmm. And I like the way of writing about that. Mm-hmm. And in a way, internally, I think I'm 9. not mentally, but my imagination is always... I have really sharp memories from that period. And I'm feeling connected to that. So
I've heard that from other authors that write young voices. I think that's great. Any questions from the audience about this passage or about some of his choices here in terms of character building or maybe in the book as a whole?
You didn't get to read the very last sentence, but I was really intrigued by that he all of a sudden is rationalizing that he wasn't awake, you know? He says, I was sound asleep, it's her mistake, insist I was sleeping.
Mm-hmm. What is your question exactly?
Well, are you making him not acknowledge, or is that some kind of guilt and he's trying to justify why he didn't get up, that it's all her fault that he didn't get up?
Yeah, I think he has the feeling that he has to do something because his mother is mistaken, and he's feeling extremely guilty because he's involved in the disappearance of his father. So somewhere in the book it said, guilt is mine and the sadness is hers. And he feels really guilty about what happened, and there's no way out and no help with that. So I think he's always feeling the guilt for things that happen. And when his mother is coming so close, and he's aware of his mother entering the room and sleeping next to him, he has the feeling that he has to do something, but his mother didn't notice he's there. So if he doesn't say anything, he can pretend he was sleeping, or he can lie about that. Lying is a very helpful thing for a child, once in a while. You can read it. I signed there afterwards. It's a mystery.
Any other questions?
But if you don't want to read it, I can tell you afterwards.
Oh, you should read it.
Hi. So when you're writing in a 9-year-old voice, how do you craft the dialogue without sounding too childish? Or how do you sound like authentic to that age group? with the dialogue for your character?
It's a good question. Actually, those dialogues come up quite easily, and mostly when I write between adults, it's more, for me, it's more difficult to write those dialogues. So it's more or less the way I write. Then it's a kind of a technique that I use. But I'll try to give a better answer. Yeah, it's children do not really use different words than we do. So they, but they skip some words or some difficult words or some words that we not do not really understand. And when I'm writing, I always want to use words that I understand myself. And most of those words, I also write children's books for really young children. Mm-hmm. And it's not really a technique or that I think I don't use this word, but I want to make it more concrete, more simple, more simple, more simple. And I skip words to make it understandable for everybody. But there's also not really an answer. No, I'm sorry, it's a too difficult question.
I think some authors have an ear for it and some don't.
Yeah, I think it's what happens. I can do something about it. Once in a while, I try to write a dialogue between two elderly people. I think you would say, no, I don't believe it. So it's... but when you read that.
One thing you can do if you're having trouble with a particular voice, and we'll keep talking more about voice, particularly with Matilda's book, find books that are either have those voice or lots of dialogue in those voice. Read them voraciously, but also transcribe them by hand. So you can kind of get a feeling for the rhythms and for the choices. And do that as much as possible to help you get that voice. I think that would be helpful.
And it helps to go outside and watch at other people how they talk.
Yes.
It's what mostly helps. To go outside, sit in a playground somewhere and listen to the conversations they have. That helps mostly, I think.
Are you sure we're not going to look creepy sitting in the playground?
Yeah, just a little. You should take another child with you. Rent a child.
Thank you.
There should be an organization for where they rent childs for writers.
We can make a lot of money.
Yeah.
Okay, so we need to move on to Lisa Haynes. Lisa Haynes is an award-winning author and senior writer in residence here at Emerson College. When We Disappear is her fourth novel. Of it, Tom Prada says, When We Disappear tells the story of a family and a country fallen on hard times and burdened by the weight of the past. Lise Haynes is a novelist of great empathy and penetrating insight. And Robert Olin Butler says, When We Disappear is a remarkable novel that does what only great fiction can do. It explores the profound interaction between our individual inner lives and the outer world, particularly that most immediate and influential corner of the world, family. And great fiction is this. Lisa Haynes has long been one of my favorite writers. Wow, that's Robert Olin Butler saying that. When We Disappear reveals her at the peak of her prodigious power. Lisa?
Thank you so much. And thank you to everyone who came out in this dreadful weather. Of course, I come from the Midwest,
yeah.
So always feels dreadful. So in this page, I have three characters. I don't know what it is about men taking off, but the father has taken off from the family. The novel is told in two voices, a daughter she's like 17, 18, 19 in there, and the father who's on the road. And the work is about a hit-and-run accident, and we slowly start to find out what happened when she was 9, and her father was young and full of energy and optimism. So after he's left, the family does go through very hard times. Mother, young daughter, she's about 5 in this scene, Lola. And Mona is telling the story. It was hard to refuse Lola. I came into the kitchen, kissed her on the cheek, and poured one cup of coffee for me, one for Mom. She had her laptop open. Sorry, she said, blowing on the cup. I have to get this one in tonight. School had turned her into the living X-ray. She was able to recite the names of all the bones of the body in under 3 minutes. And when she was really on, she could see right through you and read you like a piece of film held up to a light bulb. She spent her evenings in a world marked by lung spots, broken tibias, and damaged skulls. One doctor gave her nothing but troubling images to consider. She would point to something, a tumor or a node, and make predictions about survival rates. The ones of babies, I couldn't look at those. With her fingertips, she scrolled her computer and suddenly smiled to herself. Then she remarked on the kind of fracture she was looking at, as if the whole world hinged on the way things break, instead of the simple fact that they were broken. Second page. She wasn't sleeping much anymore. I knew this because I was up most nights listening to her not sleep. She would get so worn during the day, she wouldn't bother to put on makeup, and her hair was a mess where once it had been washed and neatly brushed each day. I saw that it had come undone from the rubber band that she had taken off the morning newspaper. I was tempted to reach over and pull that band out the rest of the way and hand her a comb, but it was hard to know what was holding her together at that point. I didn't want to pull out a linchpin. Looking at the wooden sticks on Lola's plate, I saw that she was on her third corn dog. She squatted in her chair instead of sitting the way she did sometimes when she had growing pains. That winter, the pain moved up and down her legs, and she often asked me to rub it away. I thought at first this was about sadness, about not being with friends enough. And maybe it was in part, but then I saw that her appetite had become ceaseless. And when I measured her against a door frame, she was taller.
So why did you choose this excerpt?
A very practical reason, because I only have the finished copy of the typeset edition. And I needed to start a page that started with a paragraph and ended with a paragraph.
Oh, I think it's lucky. Yeah.
But I can say that in many ways this is about the mother and the influence she has on the family and the way she's attempting to keep things together. She has been with her husband since they were teens, and she's not really grappling that well with it. So it's Mona's observations of her mother. But I think it's, and of course, the little sister, and sort of who is protecting and watching out for this little one. And so in a way, I think they're at that point where to know one character, it's very hard to tease out the other two characters because they're all working in tandem in a way. As they make this effort to survive, and they've moved into a bad neighborhood, and they're lying to the town to say that they still live in the same area, so that they can keep this young girl in her school and so on. So there's a lot around safety and how to make things work, almost as a body in a way, mm-hmm. though increasingly Mona will break away.
And there's so much that happens here. I mean, so many times novelists, they have a character in a room by themselves. You're like, can't someone else be there with them? Because putting them off with some other person adds so much tension. It helps to characterize them even more. It helps to define them more. And here you've got these three women, two women and a girl. They're in this very small house at this point, kind of cramped together.
It's an apartment.
Yeah.
And the elevated train, if you know Chicago, the elevated train goes by the window every 5 minutes.
And so everything, and Mona's not doing anything. She's just watching.
Right.
But it's full. I felt like it was still full of a lot of tension. Her mother was an artist and now needs to make some money, so she's obviously turned all her attention to her studies so she can try to make money. And notice the things that Mona notices about her mother also say things about herself. So she could see right through you and read you like a piece of film held up in a light bulb. And I don't think Mona likes being read through.
No, she does not. And she's the photographer. And that's her ambition, and that's what she cares about. And so she's always the observer, and it's much more comfortable to to be on the other side of the camera. So when that focus turns on her, she doesn't really like it.
And then the metaphor fits what she's obsessed with, her photography, which is always think of your characters as, I mean, you're using that perspective for a reason. It's like a funnel. You're using a funnel through which you're showing the reader the world through them. So everything the character's obsessed with, scared of, in love with, is going to affect all their word choice, all their descriptions of other people, all their descriptions of setting. And so she's got that right here. Yeah. And then the sister, she's taking on the mother's role for the sister, it seems like.
Yes.
You know, she's the one that's measuring her up against the door frame.
Right.
Is she getting enough to eat?
No. Massaging the growing pains and so on. And they're all in a state. You know, Lola starts hiding things under her bed.
Right.
It's just an expression, some way she can cope.
Right. And I think the novel does this so well, too, in that you get to know these characters extremely well. I always think of what you're trying to do. You're choosing characters that you can put under duress in some way and to kind of break them open to see who they actually are underneath all our social walls. And that's going to be their humanity underneath. And all these right. characters are doing that in some way. And so the mother, you're showing so much change with the mother, with the father. Do you want to speak more about the father character as well?
Sure, but I was also going to say that the idea of using the camera is... I mean, I didn't intend to go through all this in particular, but as Mona changes, the photography changes and her perceptions change. The father is one of these people who really sees himself as a good man and has always wanted to be a good man. And when he loses his job and moves to another state to support the family in this very traditional roles they're playing, he's really coming unhinged. He's wandering, and there's a part of him that embraces that idea. Oh, maybe there's a different man in me. Maybe there's a different life. Maybe there's something I didn't live. And then there's the other part that's just terrified that he won't be able to come back, that his family won't embrace him, that they won't welcome him home.
And he's beginning to cross a lot of boundaries, too. An early scene in which he's with this woman, and he seems to decide that having, you know, doing oral sex to her is okay, and it's not breaking his marriage.
I never say it.
No, you never say it. You actually did that very well, because I was like... I was like, is he cheating on her? What's happening? But he doesn't think, obviously something's happened, but he still thinks that he's faithful.
Yeah, he says he's doing something he imagines will please her.
Right.
He doesn't want anything for himself, but he wants to please her.
And so it's such a... It's so selfish and then pretending not to be.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. It's such an interesting character. It's difficult to go there with a character like that.
Well, I wrote Mona's character first, and the whole book was told from her perspective. And then eventually, for various reasons, I went back in to tell his side of things. And one of the things I did was imagine that he had a slight Irish accent just to really hear his voice as unique. And, you know, I worried as a woman if I would get him right.
Yeah. And I think that's great. I think there are little tricks that we use as writers for ourselves, like a voice accent or something like that, or a little something that they wear, a habit that they have, to really try to first kind of get yourself in that character and begin to learn them. So that's a great trick.
And it's not a brogue. It's just a real subtle thing that I was hearing in my head.
Right. Questions about this excerpt or about her character decisions in the book as a whole? No questions. You said you decided to start just with Mona, but decided to move on to the father. Why did you decide to use him?
sometime I'll tell you the whole story around that.
Okay.
but I was glad that I did in the end. because I have a couple of fathers in my books, and they don't always fare well. And I wanted to feel like I could get fully inside him and find that point of compassion with him.
Right.
So,
which I think you did very well.
Thank you.
Compassion for characters that you otherwise don't condone what they do. I think people, a lot of times, they have a very difficult time. The character becomes very flat, very much like a villain. And I'm always pushing my students, like, try to find something that you're compassionate about, something that you have in similarities with that character, so that you can kind of understand, well, I understand their emotional journey. I just wouldn't have gone there at the end. I think that's so important.
Right. How many people are in the room are writers? Ah, a lot. Okay. So some of you go through the method of plotting everything out in advance, figuring out where you're going to move your characters, you know what they're like, and so on. And then some writers, like I do, I just drop in to the middle of something, I hear a voice or image, and so on. And I get to know the characters, and to me it's a form of extremely vivid daydreaming. How many people go through that kind of scenario? Ah, that's interesting. More people are plotting out in advance and getting to, you know what you want your characters to do. How many people know what they want their characters to do? Oh, ambivalence here. Okay. I want to find out what they're going to do, but you can change the physical impetus. You can say, okay, well, I'm not going to have a car accident, or it's going to be a really rainy day today, or someone has a cold. But even though characters contradict themselves, as we do, you can't, or I can't tell them how they're going to react.
Do you know, since he blurbed your book, do you know the Robert Olin Butler craft book that he did?
I have not.
It's called something like Dreaming the Something. Did you know it?
James
Dorming? Yeah, something like that. Something like that.
He just lived through the storm, by the way.
Oh, did he?
Yeah, he and his wife live in a town of two. in Florida, right there on the...
But are they the town then together?
They are literally the entire town.
Wow.
And their dogs.
And they just... Yeah. But I do think it's called Dream Storming or... From Where You Dream. Yes.
Okay.
So I remember I had it on my bookshelf forever. I didn't like the title because I thought it sounded corny. But it's really quite good. So Robert Olin Butler's From Where You Dream. And there's a chapter in there that he uses called A Writer Prepares, and he talks about a process of pre-dreaming a book. And it's a great way of planning out a book that's somewhere between intuitive and critical mind. And so I would recommend that if you're having trouble kind of doing the planning. It's pretty unique, and I think he explains it well. Good. Let's move on to Matilda. Bernstein Sycamore is an author and a queer activist. Her 2013 memoir, The End of San Francisco, won the 2014 Lambda Literary Award. Her second novel, Sketchtassie, I'm murdering that.
Sketchtassie.
It's your third novel. Yeah. Yes, okay. Is a story of Alexa, a 21-year-old queen who rejects middle-class pretensions and searches for nourishment in the gay culture of mid-90s Boston, a culture bonded by clubs and conformity, willful apathy, and the specter of AIDS. Alexander Chi said of the book, reading, once I get a word wrong, I'm always going to get it wrong. Sketchtacity.
Sketchtacy.
Yes, like fantasy.
Like ecstasy.
Is like a night of stealing other people's drinks or a much-needed slap to the face or a little of both. Bold, glittering, wise, fun, the novel is a found poem alive in the mouth of this truth-telling queen making her way through a wasteland of other people's lives and a few of her own and looking for something near paradise. Follow her and live. Incredible. Okay, do you want to read your excerpt?
Yes. I like to stand when I read.
So yeah, all you really need to know is, yeah, it takes place in 1995. Alexa's a 21-year-old queen. And actually, the excerpt I'm reading takes place, you'll notice, just down the street, since the whole book takes place in Boston. And she has just gotten a new job. So now I'm doing time at the exclusive Copley Place. Not in the mall exactly, but in those upstairs offices facing the magnificent Broken Sun sculpture that pours water onto the hallowed granite Neiman Marcus shoppers tread. But don't get all excited thinking I have that gorgeous view, because this is classic office realness. So of course, my lovely cubicle faces another lovely cubicle. And behind that lovely cubicle, I can glimpse another lovely cubicle facing me, my cubicle, and I. My highly sought after position consists of making crank calls for the uncommon clout Visa card. You know, the card that gives back to the gay and lesbian community with every purchase. And when I say uncommon clout gives back, honey, I do mean gives back. That's right. Every time you use your uncommon clout Visa card, we make a donation of 10 cents to the nonprofit of your choice. You heard me right. 10 cents. Before you know it, you'll be using that card, honey. Using that card and saving our gay children 10 cents at a time. Don't worry. You don't even have to call 1-800-GAY-CLOUT, because you've got this bitch on the phone to set you up with the debt bondage you've been waiting for. But there's absolutely no pressure. I'll just sign you up, and then you can cancel when you get your balance up to $24,999. I'm not working for the collectors, honey. All I need is your name, address, and social security number. Or, if you prefer, you can just give me your abusive father's name, address, and social security number, and we'll go with that. We here at Uncommon Clout are nothing if not flexible, and I would like my $2 commission.
So, Matilda, why did you choose this excerpt?
Well, I chose that excerpt because I feel like the most important thing to Alexa's character is the voice. And I feel like in that excerpt, the voice really shines through, and also her scathing humor, as well as you know, her critique of gay culture, and her critique of Boston, her critique of family, and also maybe her place of being stuck within all of those things at the same time. Because she is, of course, working for the Uncommon Clout Visa card.
How did you find this voice?
Well, I also am a queen. I know, probably no one knew that. I did live in Boston at that time. And so I think her voice, in a way, is a little more of an extreme version of myself. So I cut out some of the things that perhaps... So I think the book, in a way, is about her being trapped. So trapped in a city rapidly afraid of difference, trapped in a gay culture that magnifies the worst aspects of straight normalcy while claiming to offer something else, trapped in this moment, so 1995, growing up, she's 21, growing up with AIDS, suffusing her desires, and not being able to imagine a way out. But within that trapped, there is, you know, there's a lot of flamboyance and transgression and critique and a kind of like explosive insight and incisiveness in a certain way. And so there's that dynamic between them, but I've forgotten your question already. Did I answer it?
did I forget my question? How did you find the voice?
Oh, yeah. So basically the voice came from all of those things. You know, and it's written in the Queen's vernacular, right? So it's taking the language of Queens and making that the center. So I think often, you know, when we're not what is supposedly the center, right? So that means like straight, white, Christian men. If we're supposed to write to those people, right? So we're supposed to make a world that is immediately legible to, you know, like some guy who's, you know, working at Goldman Sachs or something and nothing else. So we have to like explain everything, right? So I don't do that ever. Because I think that explication takes away from the character. And so for me, you enter on the terms of the narrator. And for me, that actually makes it more accessible and more intimate, more raw, and it makes it more possible to actually feel it.
That problem of explaining, because in writing workshops we deal with that a lot, because a lot of marginalized writers feel that people in the room might not understand what's going on, so that they have to explain. And yet, explaining reduces the work. Mm-hmm. And I've heard some people say, well, yes, then, because if they don't explain, they'll be invisible. But I'm always just like, no, just make people work for it. Just make them deal with it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that's the best advice.
Yeah.
Because for me, as soon as you explain, you know, it's not really a book anymore. You know, I mean, it's a book of some sort, but it's not, you can't be immersed, right? It's taking away from the felt sense of it. And it's interesting, actually, someone, when I finished the manuscript, I was giving it to friends, you know, to read, including a couple people who have lived in Boston, you know, since 1995. And one reader, he said one of the other things that he really liked about it is also I don't explain Boston. So I think that's another thing in books. If you're not in New York, if the book's not set in New York, we're supposed to explain, like, what is Boylston or something, you know what I mean? Or Mass Ave, or, you know, like, oh, Mass Ave is a major thoroughfare that traverses the city in, you know, this particular direction. So I also don't do that. You know, they're just on Boylston, there's a wind tunnel, and you just deal with it, you know? And so I think in a way that's my philosophy about writing in general is, that the explication takes away. And I think also that's why I embrace voice. Mm-hmm. As kind of a central way. Because for me, I didn't have a plot when I wrote this book. There is a plot that happens, but I did not intend it. I just went with the voice, went with the time period, went with... and also, interestingly, I did not realize when I started the book that AIDS would actually play a central role. It's just that when I'm writing about 1995... So we, like, knowing... Now we can look back and say, oh, in 1995, something was about to change, right? So we were about to have medications that could actually extend people's lives and change the face of AIDS in this country. But no one in the book can imagine that. More people died in the U.S. of AIDS in 1995 than any other year. So there's no way for these characters to imagine that there's any possibility of moving beyond that. And so that also became central because I was thinking about the time period. And I think also through voice, and sometimes through, because a lot of these characters are very hypocritical because they're growing up in a hypocritical culture and they internalize that. So a lot of it is coming through shade, you know, things people say, like, you know, the most racist, misogynist, homophobic, and AIDS-phobic and femphobic things within gay culture, you know? Mm-hmm. And so some of it just came through these things that people say, and then that brought me deeper, you know, into the time period and actually created a plot.
Mm-hmm. Did you... I find that this can be difficult, and I don't know how long you worked on the book for, but if you're working on a book for... usually take a year. Sometimes for people, their books take 10 years. the voice changes. Mm-hmm, did you mm-hmm. find that happening at all, or was it just... you just knew it from the get-go and you were able to stick with it?
Well, I think the voice... I mean, for me, what I do is I edit out anything that gets in the way of the voice. So the voice did not change, I wouldn't say, in the course of the book, but the insights do change. And one thing that really changes, actually... there was one character I created really just to embody the worst contradictions of Boston, and Boston gay culture in particular. And I did not have an intention for that character to be a main character. It was just someone who just showed up, you know, boom, boom, you know, had these lines. And then Alexa's just like, oh, this, you know, she just can't stand this person. So that person becomes a love interest, you know, and actually becomes, they fall in love, you know. And then I did not intend that at all. So that was like an interesting thing. To me, also came through, like, because I created this character that was totally hypocritical, kind of what you were saying before. I didn't intend this, but then it actually becomes, you know, she's a character, right? So you actually, and there's something inside, right? So I think that's. I mean, the book kind of starts with that hypocrisy, but also within any hypocrisy, right? There's something beyond that, you know. And it doesn't mean the hypocrisy goes away, but it means that there is the potential for a full range of everything, right? You know, love, hate, you know, intimacy, betrayal, heartbreak, all of it. And so that was actually, perhaps for me writing it, that was the biggest surprise, because this character, Avery is the name of the character in the book, but I was like, and actually I even, you know, like she says when Avery is introduced, she's like an eraser or a hole puncher, you know, or something like that. And like, it was even like the name of the character, right? Which I didn't know that immediately when I wrote it, but yeah, it becomes a central character, you know, one of probably the four or five central characters in the book.
And then notice that, so your main characters, all her inner conflicts, her loves, her hates, everything. In writing a novel, you need to make those you need to get them out of the person's head, out of the person's interior. So it the world around them becomes a mirror, a concrete mirror to their interior conflicts. So if you can find characters that in some way represent those things, you don't want the characters to be too simplified in that way. But then I love that character then becomes a love interest, because that's even more problematic, and that works really well. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's great. Questions about this excerpt or about other choices that she has made in, yes, in the back there. Let's see, we have a microphone.
I'm curious, in this excerpt, is Alexa talking to a general public or to a specific person, or who's the audience in this excerpt as well as for the rest of the book?
Sure. I think this is perhaps one of the more performative excerpts in a certain sense. So I think because Alexa is a queen, and, you know, speaking in the queen's vernacular, a lot of just talking about anything is a performance, right? And part of that performance is survival, right? Survival in Boston, where, you know, she just gets on the T and, you know, someone's telling her they want to kill her. Or like walking home, you know, living in East Boston, someone stops his baby carriage and starts screaming and says, "What are you doing in my neighborhood?" You know, and she's like, "Well, this is my neighborhood too." So the performance is necessary in order to survive. And I think that's true of all the characters in the book. And part of that performance is also a shutting off, right? So a shutting off of feeling the full range of emotion, which is necessary in order to survive. And so I think there's always that dynamic between projecting invulnerability and feeling vulnerability at the same time.
Other questions?
Love Queen's vernacular. I'm going to steal it, but I will attribute it. But you've got a character talking in kind of what you're describing as a common vernacular. How did you make her voice unique within that? Like what?
Sure. Yeah. So I think the thing that makes her the most unique, her voice, I think, is because she has a scathing political analysis. So she really has what I would call a radical queer analysis. So an analysis that, you know, mainstream gay culture is just as problematic as dominant straight culture. And but she does not have a way of actualizing that. There is no world around her that offers that. And so she's immersed in gay club culture of that time. So, you know, going, basically her life starts at like 5 p.m. and ends around 9 a.m. So it's the opposite. It's the 5 to 9 schedule. And so I think what makes the voice really unique is is that all those things happening at once. So I think, you know, for one thing, for example, like Boston gay culture, and this happens a lot in the book, you know, is extremely misogynist. And she is extremely critical of that, you know. And so her way of talking is this sort of combination, this synthesis, in a way, of the Queen's vernacular and of a sort of radical, like a political direct action kind of lineage at the same time.
Other questions?
This is a question for any one of you three, I guess. All of you have extremely, really vivid settings that are almost characters in and of themselves. How do you balance the character of the setting with the characters of the people without one overwhelming the other?
Great. Who wants to go first?
We all look at you.
No,
just kidding.
You. He's doing his pointing thing again.
I can go first. I don't mind. Yeah. So for me, I don't know that there has to be a balance, because I think a book can be about imbalance as much as about balance. And for me, Boston is definitely a huge character, right? And it is encroaches on everyone in the book. Boston is a suffocating place. There is a potential for a kind of pageantry that maybe can transcend that suffocation, but at the same time, there is always that suffocation. So I think there is always that dynamic. And I think there is, I mean, at different times, one overwhelms the other, but I think, for me, I feel like the imbalance is just as important as the balance.
Please?
For me, this particular neighborhood where the family ends up, it's the neighborhood where my mother used to look out at a cemetery from our apartment while I was in utero. It is
That's
the place
a great image, that
where
whole
my,
idea.
Where my boyfriend in college used to shoot up speed. It's the neighborhood where my stepfather eventually died. He was my best friend. It was I was born in June, and it was the street was Juneway Terrace, and so I never thought in advance, okay, now I want to balance something out. I simply, as I moved through this landscape, I wanted to record something honest. But what I learned when I went back to see family and went driving through this area is that the elevated platform had changed entirely. It used to be the old wooden structure, the way we have, you know, the old wooden roller coasters. And so it would really make a lot of noise and vibration and the clacking and so on. And they took all of that out and they put concrete in, which kind of broke my heart. And I thought, okay, so, and someone jumps off this platform at a certain point. So am I going to go with the actual concrete of today, because it's a current day book? And I thought, no, I'm going to stick with that platform, because that felt really pivotal to me. So I gave myself certain freedoms to do that.
And settings that are associated with so many different events and then carry all those layers. That's wonderful. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yep.
Yeah, for me, it started when I started writing. In the beginning, it was happened in the Netherlands and in a city at the beach. And then I thought, no, I need an island. And more it became a more remote island. And in a way, it's a character, because the island gets smaller over the years. When Mikael grows, the island gets smaller for him. But to answer your question, for me, it's always good to think, where's my book about? And when it's about what happens between the mother and the son, then that is the main thing, and all the island thing needs to be supportive for that. So what can I use, or what is necessary, or what is interesting for that? And it's very easy to get lost in describing a beautiful island with rocks and stone and kind of Scandinavian tourist guide thing. And I wrote many pieces, and then I took them away. Is that good? No. I scrapped them. Is that better?
Yes.
Mm. I scrapped them. So yeah, it's always good to check out what do you need, or what is too much, or what is too overdone.
Yeah.
Can I have one thing?
We're going to actually have to break.
Okay, sure. Yeah, no problem.
I know. Sadly, I think we could go on for another half hour. So if you have more questions for them, they'll be signing their books at the back. And remember that authors can't eat or pay their rent or really walk their dogs or do anything unless they're making some money. And the only way they can do that is by selling books. So please try to support them. Thank you very much.
Michelle. Thank you.